Well, good Friday evening, everyone. This is Pam Stack. I'm your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, I have a very special guest with me. His name is Mark Henshaw. Mark is a decorated Central Intelligence Agency analyst for about 15 years. He's won numerous exceptional performance awards and all kinds of national intelligence awards, like the Galileo Award. You know, that means he's really smart. He's got a Bachelor of Political Science. He's got a Master's in Business Administration and International Relations. He's gone to school a whole bunch of times and a lot of different places. He's a resident of the Commonwealth of Virginia and is a big war battle history buff. He also plays tabletop war games. I can't wait to hear what that's about. Programs computers, studies the culinary arts, and listens to far more Bruce Hornsby music than is healthy. That I agree with. He also is a very fine writer of 3 books in a Red Cell series. We're going to talk to Mark about it right now. Mark Henshaw, welcome to Authors on the Air.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so pleased that you're here. And with your bio, I want to just start right away by saying you're way too smart for me. Don't use big words. But tell me, what are tabletop war games? Do you line up army men on a field or something?
yeah, actually.
Tabletop
really? War game, yeah. I mean, you find a whole lot of, military guys, intelligence analysts, people like that, just who are military history buffs. You know, they love to go and reenact famous battles in history. And so they go and they actually spend a lot of time building, you know, miniature battlefields and painting all of these little figures. And you put them on a board. And, you know, there's rules that you follow for how you do this. And, some of these guys have huge collections of very detailed military models and characters that they use to go and reenact, you know, everything from, you know, ancient Roman armies all the way up to the latest and greatest weapons that you have out on the battlefield. There's just something about losing yourself in replaying the Battle of Gettysburg, you know, and trying different things, you know, see if you can win where Robert E. Lee lost and whatnot. So, it's the whole thing.
Is this something that you do solo? Do you do with other enthusiasts? Do you do with family? Are you like going shooting the gun and everything as you're marching your little army man down the field? I'm not, you know, I'm only envisioning my younger brothers, all as kids playing with them. I have seen some people who create these very intricate tableaus. Is that what you do and then you leave it in place? Or is there a strategy behind doing this?
it's definitely a lot more fun to do it with somebody else than to just do it by yourself in the basement, you know.
Right.
And, yeah, you don't tend to sit around making the sound effects, you know, the way that you do. But, you go down to your local, there's game shops and places where, you know, they'll have tables set up and guys will go in there for a few hours on a Friday night and sit there and they'll replay these battles. And, depending on who you're playing with, some people are, you know, very casual about it, but then there are other guys who are the hardcore, you know, hobbyists, you know, military historian types who get very deeply into it, you know, okay, I want to go replay this little section of this little battle and try a brand new strategy tonight and, you know, see how that might play out or whatever. So it can be as serious as you want it to be. Unfortunately, it is a hobby, which can also start to chew up a lot of money. You know, those little miniature figurines
sure.
aren't necessarily the cheapest things. But, you know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, people who really are into history and who don't just want to read about it in books, but they actually want to sort of make it interactive and get into it and try different things and see if they could make history play out a different way. So it's just
do you go to any reenactments, to the reenactor performances that are done at some of these battlefields?
You know, I've gone and I've attended some of those. I'm not one of the guys who actually dresses up in the clothes and goes out there and does all that, although I have a very good friend who does that. He actually does British artillery, in fact. He decided he didn't want to be on the side of the colonials. He wanted to be on the side of the British because not too many people reenact the Redcoats. And last year, his unit actually got to camp out on the grounds of Mount Vernon right in front of George Washington's house. I mean, you know, with his cannon, he actually could have put a cannonball right through George Washington's window. So it's just, it's very interesting to see those guys who want to take, you know, making history interactive and take it to an entirely different level and do that. And they were camping out with the old tents and cooking their meals with the old kind of gear and
wow,
all of that. So I appreciate guys who can get into it that far and who do that, but I confess I'm not one of them. I don't take it quite.
Well, you enjoy it, though. And then, of course, following right in line with that, you study the culinary arts. I can so see the relationship there. Not. You like to cook. Did you go to culinary arts school? Have you taken classes? You're obviously a foodie. You're in a state that has some pretty good restaurants. Jamestown and Williamsburg, those areas I'm familiar with and have some very good restaurants. What is it about the culinary arts that you're fascinated with?
Yeah, I've never actually taken a formal class in it in my life. I just, sometime back in college, I figured out it was easier to get girls to come over to my apartment if I could, you know, cook something better than ramen and hot dogs for them. And,
it's always about the woman, you know? It's always the woman's fault or motivation, right?
Yeah, I started getting into it for that reason, and then suddenly I realized, you know, hey, you know, it's one of those things I actually think that every guy ought to learn to do. And, you know, I don't when guys are getting married, I don't give them marital advice, but the one thing I will tell them is learn to cook, because, you know, when you come home at the end of the day, if your wife is worn out and tired and you can make dinner for her, she'll think you're amazing. Or you come home and she's cooking in the kitchen and you go cook right next to her, you know, she'll think you're amazing. And if you come home and she's not there for whatever reason, you can make something for yourself better than ramen and hot dogs. So there is no downside for a guy knowing how to cook. And, you know, if you're a single guy and you can cook something really nice for your date, you know, she'll be mightily impressed.
Mark, I don't want to say you're a cliche, but good for you that you know how to cook and it's all about the woman. I'm giving you a pass on that. I am, however, questioning your sanity when you tell me that you are a fan of Bruce Hornsby. Now, I don't know how many records the man put out, but I don't recall that he's had hit year after year. That doesn't dull your enthusiasm for his music?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, his first record, Bruce Hornsby and the Range, they did The Way It Is, and I want to say he won the Grammy for Best New Artist back in, I want to say it was 86. And, no, he does, you know, he doesn't put out, you know, hit after hit every year. You know, and in fact, in interviews with him, you know, he got, you know, he's the kind of musician who got really tired of, you know, playing the same three chords over and over. Really fast, in fact, and he started getting very experimental with his music, you know, probably about his third record, and, you know, I don't think he's actually had a hit on the radio in the early 90s, and that doesn't bother him at all, you know, because he's the kind of guy who just, he can't sit still with his music, he's always trying to grow and expand, and if you go to one of his concerts, in fact, you know, he basically takes pride in never playing a song the same way twice. So you could go see him one night, and he'll play things one way, and then you could go see him literally the next night somewhere else, and he would play the same set of songs, but he would play them in a different way.
Interesting.
So you really don't know what you're getting with him, but it's definitely not the kind of thing where he's going to sit down and he's going to play the song, you know, that was a hit 30 years ago. He's going to sit down and play it exactly the way it was on the record 30 years ago, just because that bores the daylights out of him.
I would imagine it bores everybody else too, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's some people, you know, there's some artists who, you know, they make a career out of going and touring and playing the exact same songs the exact same way over and over for 30 years, and people go and attend those concerts, and there's a nostalgia value to that, but I'm sure the musicians at some point are wishing that they could, you know, sort of stretch their boundaries. And Hornsby, just the kind of guy, he figured out years ago, he wasn't going to be one of those who's going to spend 30 years playing the way it is exactly the same way he did back in 86. And so he's just the kind of guy who has always gone on and done a lot of different things, and I really appreciate that. And, you know, you listen to his albums, he's gotten all kinds of guest artists, everyone from Sean Colvin to, I want to say, Elton John's, you know, been on some of his albums.
Uh-huh.
I mean, some really famous names you would recognize have played with him. He played with the Grateful Dead for a while. You know, Jerry Garcia played on some of his albums. So, yeah, it's just a really broad array of things, and you're always being taken into a new field with him. So it's a very expanding way to listen to your music.
So I'm picturing you from your bio picture, and I'm visualizing in your kitchen, there's a big table with the army tableau laid out, and in the background is a loop of Bruce Hornsby while you're stirring the bouillabaisse and also thinking about how you're going to program a computer. But really, truly, that's not you. Those are just components, because you are a fabulous author, and that's what I want to talk to you about.
Well, thank you.
So let's talk about books. I received a copy of The Fall of Moscow Station, sitting right next to me, as a matter of fact. I love this story. I love the characters. As we spoke before the show began, and I mentioned to you that I'm a huge fan of political and spy, you know, espionage, intrigue, thrillers, that type of thing, always have been. And I also, when I was doing a little research on you, noted that Jason Matthews, who wrote Red Sparrow and Palace of Treason, also really enjoyed and blurbed your new book, The Fall of Moscow Station. Jason was a guest on the show also. But this, what surprised me to learn was that this is not your first book. It's actually your third book in a red, what is called the Red Cell series, where you've introduced us to Kira Stryker and to Jonathan Burke. Take us back to Red Cell, book number one by Mark Henshaw.
That was my first novel. Came out in 2012, although I actually had been writing it for some years before that. And, you know, I mean, I really got into that book because there was a character in there in the first book. His name is Pioneer. He's a Chinese asset for the CIA in that book. And I really wanted to sort of explore why somebody would commit treason against their own country, you know. And he's based on a real person, on a real Russian who spied for the CIA for, gosh, I don't know how many, actually it wasn't the CIA he ended up spying for, but he was an archivist for the KGB.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, as the archivist, he would sit there every day and he would see all of the reports come into the building about everything that the Russians were doing, you know, during these Cold War years. And he was so appalled by what he saw. He was trying to figure out how he could sort of undermine them. So he would sit there and every day he would write down sort of, you know, one report, copy it down, fold it up in a piece of paper, hide it in his shoe, and walk out of the building with it. And he did this for decades, you know. And by the time he was done, he had three or four trunk loads of papers. And he actually came to the agency, you know, made contact with the agency, and he said, I want to defect. And the agency thought that he was what's called in the business a dangle. He thought that the KGB was dangling this guy in front of him to try and get the agency to bite on him, and then they were going to use him to feed the agency false information or whatever. And so the agency said no. They turned him down. So he ended up going to the British, and the British decided to take a chance on him, and they smuggled him out of the country with his four trunk loads of paper. And, you know, they had gotten a couple of really good books out of that, documenting basically everything that the KGB was doing during the Cold War. And reading about that guy's story, I was really fascinated about it, and I thought, you know, if you were that guy, if you were stuck in this country under this authoritarian regime that would shoot you, you know, if they knew what you were doing, how do you live that way? How do you live with that kind of pressure on you, knowing every single day could be your last day on Earth. That if they found you, they're going to drag you off and take you out. And so I sort of started writing that story as kind of a character study of this guy. And so the first story, Red Cell, evolved out of that. And, you know, Kira and Jonathan, you know, those are my two main characters. And I put them in a unit called the Red Cell, which is actually a real CIA unit. I actually try to make up as little as possible in my stories.
Let me stop you right there for a second, Mark.
Yes.
When you're using the name of actual programs or whatever they are, divisions, departments, when you know, you have a kind of partial seal of the Central Intelligence Agency on your book, kind of floated off into the background, and you do use some of these names. Do you have to get permission first before you do something like this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, every person who ever works for the agency, one of the very first things you do on your very first day as they're processing you in, you have to sign basically a legal contract that says that if you're ever going to publish anything on the outside related to, you know, the agency or intelligence or anything that you work on while you're at the agency, you have to submit it first to a group in the agency, which is called the Publication Review Board. And that contract that you sign is lifelong. It follows you even after you leave the agency. So, you know, even if you become an ex-CIA person, if you're writing about that, you're still having to submit your stuff. And so you do. You submit it to them, and they go through and they review it. And, you know, if there's something that they think would be revealing classified information, they'll come back and say, you can't do that. You need to either change that or delete it. So I've gone back and forth with them on a few things, and you know, it actually hasn't really been that bad. I've had a few disputes with them where I've had to come back and defend, you know, why I should be allowed to keep something in there. I've usually won most of those. I was able to make a pretty good case.
So Red Cell is an actual... What is Red Cell? It's a division, a group, a unit? What? I'm not sure exactly what it is.
Yeah, the Red Cell is it's actually a pretty small team of analysts. It was the first Red Cell was created on September 13th, 2001. By then CIA Director George Tenet, you know, on September 11th, you know, the minute that second plane hit the second tower in New York, it became obvious that to the agency that they had suffered what Congress would later call a failure of imagination. You know, the dots were there, but nobody connected them because nobody could conceive of what seemed, you know, in retrospect, to be so outlandish. I mean, if you had gone in borders on September 10th and said, I think that terrorists will hijack four airliners and try and slam them into, you know, various buildings around the U.S., they'd have thought you were crazy. You know, they'd run you out of the place. And then on September 12th, everybody would have looked at you like you were some kind of a prophet or something. But you know, it was so far outside the realm of our experience that nobody was willing to entertain that possibility.
Well, with that thought in mind, let me ask you a question, and we're going to go back to the book. Is there now anything out of the realm of possibility, or is everything on the table for discussion?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like you were saying, if you would walk in on September 10th and said that, people would think you're crazy. I wonder, do the powers that be and all the alphabet agencies, if someone were to walk in and say something totally off the wall, are they poo-pooed the way they were? Maybe it would have been on September 10th?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the whole point of the Red Cell unit is to have somebody in the building who's looking at, you know, possibilities that other people, you know, haven't considered or don't want to consider or sort of reject out of hand. George Tenet handpicked. He had his senior staff to sort of handpick a couple of people from inside the building, and I know the guys that he picked. You know, I got to work with them. Because I was part of that unit for 3 years. And, you know, he told them, he said two things. He said, number one, I want you to tell me what nobody else is willing to tell me. You know, offer me those possibilities that nobody else really wants to say. And second, he said, I want you to make the other analysts around here nervous. You know, he said, I want you to be sitting here coming up with these scenarios and these possibilities and make these other analysts sit down and force them to defend, you know, why those things sort of aren't true and why what they think is happening really is, you know.
Wow.
And so, as you can imagine, you know, the Red Cell must be a really popular group inside the agency because they're, you know.
I would imagine not.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you go in there and, I mean, it's been interesting to sit there and deal with other analysts and see the hostility coming out sometimes. Because, nobody likes to be second-guessed or nobody likes to have somebody else saying, well, what about this other possibility? And, you know, so they wanted to have that one unit that was always putting everything on the table. You know, I mean, now obviously some things are out just simply because, you know, you have to obey the laws of physics at some point. And, you're not
right.
Going off into the realm of science fiction here. But,
no, I understand.
The idea is that they are looking at ideas which are possible but not probable is what they say. You know,
it sounds like, these people are like the governmental spy version of the great debate team, you know, they're going to have a pros and cons and kind of discuss things like that or shout or scream or whatever it is, make their point about their own side. And I guess that's a good thing. I'm not smart enough to know that. You are, and, you know, so Red Cell became part of your book. And as a matter of fact, that is the name of this series right now because Kira Stryker, who's a rookie when you introduce her, is paired with Jonathan Burke, who kind of is a know-it-all, but he's a know-it-all who's generally correct. He's right. Isn't that correct?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, they're kind of my Holmes and Watson. You know, he's sort of... It's kind of backwards in that he's the brain and she's the muscle, so to speak.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
You know, and it's
I like
not
that,
that
though.
Yeah, it's not that he's always correct, but by entertaining the possibilities, you know, in his mind that other analysts don't want to look at, you know, there are certain times where he is able to figure things out that other analysts simply can't, because they. You know, they don't want to look at those, you know, low probability, high impact events is what they are. I mean, if you think about it, you know, 99% of the time we wake up every morning assuming that today is going to look pretty much like yesterday. You know, we don't expect any huge radical change to
right.
happen on any given day from the day before. And most days it doesn't. And so we get into these very comfortable mental ruts going through our days, you know, just handling things. And occasionally we'll come up with a little problem, you know, problem gets thrown our way, but we deal with it or whatever. And then every so often something happens and just it seems like the whole world just jumps the tracks, you know. And those are the things that Jonathan is looking out for. You know, other analysts, and I've seen this in the agency, other analysts, you know, they sort of get into these mental ruts. They expect tomorrow will look like today and today looks like yesterday and whatnot. And then you have a 9/11. And so Jonathan is the guy who's always sitting there and he's sort of always looking for the next 9/11. He sees these events in the world and he says, if these two things are connected, what does that mean? And it means that things will be radically different tomorrow. And so he's able to go and he's able to figure things out that other analysts can't. And the interesting thing for Kira in the first book, you know, she comes in as the new person and she doesn't understand his way of thinking, but she starts glomming onto it pretty quickly. And by the third book here, Moscow Station, you realize she's really learned how to do that. And there's a good stretch in Moscow Station where Jonathan's not there. And she's
right.
the one who has to do it. And she processes through, and for the first time without his help, she's able to do it, and so she ends up becoming both Holmes and Watson in the book, where she's able to figure out what's going on, and then she's the one who has to go out and do something about it. And so Moscow Station is really the book where she kind of breaks out on her own a little bit and proves that she can do this and she doesn't need Jonathan to do the thinking at all. She's been growing.
You're not breaking up the team, are you? You're not breaking them up as a team for book purposes. Will you write again about Stryker and Burke?
Oh yeah, I'm actually working on the fourth book right now. You know, and it, you know, not that I want to break the team up, but that I definitely wanted her to be able to be completely independent, in the sense that she can work well, yeah, work well either with him or on her own when she needs to. But she doesn't sit there and she doesn't have to depend on him to think about things and then tell her what she needs to be doing. She needs to be able to do it as well as he does for them to be true partners and a true team. And that's where I wanted to get him. And so,
who is your lead character? Who do you think is your lead character?
You know, when I first started writing Red Cell, you know, I kind of anticipated Kara being the lead character, but I think in that book and definitely in the second book, she and Jonathan are very much sort of equals. And, you know, they're both the lead together, neither one individually is lead. In this third book, Kara is very definitely the lead character.
Would Jonathan be able Kara understands how Jonathan's mind works and how he connects dots. Would Jonathan be able to learn and assimilate Kira's skills? Would he do as well without her as she does without him?
Well, that's the interesting thing is no, he wouldn't. And he recognizes that. You know, if you read the second book, which gives you some of his backstory, you know, you get most of her backstory in the first one. You get a lot of his backstory in the second one. You know, he has been out in the field and he's given that up. And he's given that up for a very good reason. He's come on in. He's decided to be an analyst. But, you know, there's something about him. I write him as though he sort of suffers a little bit from Asperger's, you know, not a severe case. But he can't read people the way that Kara can. She can read body language and cues and signs and things like that in a way that, you know, it's not quite like Sherlock Holmes. You know, he can just stare at you and tell you everything about you. But she can look at you, and she can tell a heck of a lot about you and what you're thinking and what you're going to do. And he can't do that. He's blind to that. And
well,
so
excuse me for 1 minute, Mark. I should explain that the second book is called Cold Shot, and this involves an Iranian nuclear scientist hell-bent on building a bomb. So that's, you know, there's Venezuela's in it, and there's a Somali pirate involved, so there are a lot of things going on, but they are still in the Red Cell think tank working through. So,
yeah.
And so now the third book in this series is The Fall of Moscow Station, and this is the one where Kara definitely takes the leap as the main character, simply because she already has the street smarts and those skills, and she's to learn from Jonathan Burke the ability to analyze a situation and to think, what if? What about this?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, from the very first book, he's known that eventually she was going to surpass him. That she was going to end up being better at that kind of work than he was because, you know, she had, you know, the experience on the street. She had the ability to read people and look at them and integrate all these things that he couldn't. You know, he's very good analytically, but when it comes to people, I won't say useless, but he's just not very good at it. And in fact, he sort of annoys people and angers them without even realizing he's doing it. So he's been going along the entire time knowing eventually she's going to be better at this than he is. And he's okay with that, you know, because he's older than she is. He's like, I'm not going to be around here forever, you know, and if I'm eventually going to retire from this business and somebody's going to replace me, I would love to be replaced by somebody who's actually better at this than I am, who can do this. And he definitely thinks she's that person.
You're writing the fourth book. In between all of the things that you do, you know, and we joked a little bit earlier, but you are a huge follower of history, American history particularly, but with all of your battles and everything, you're really into that. You like to cook and you like to try new things, and you program computers, and I'm assuming you listen to more than just Bruce Hornsby. There are other kind of music that you listen to. Plus, you have a family and a dog. Plus your job. Where in the world do you find time to write?
Anywhere that I can, mostly. Most days I am out of bed by 4:30 in the morning, maybe 5 o'clock at the latest. I try to be at my desk at work by 6. Put in an 8.5 hour day means I'm heading out the door at 2:30 in the afternoon, which you kind of got to do in Northern Virginia, because if you know what the rush hour traffic around here is like, you don't want to have any part of that.
How close are you to the naval bases?
Oh, no, the naval bases like Newport News and all that, that's down on the coast. That's, 4 hours. Yeah, 4 hours
so
drive from here.
Because that's a nightmare. Driving around there is a nightmare. I've been to that part. Well, I've been to Williamsburg too, so I know that area. But and actually, some of my favorite writers are in Virginia. But So you want to get away from the traffic and get home.
Yeah. And
do you write when you get home?
Yeah, my wife, wonderful woman that she is. Basically, when I'm writing a book, she plays single mom for months at a time. I come home and I will help her in the kitchen and help her with the kids and everything. And then at about 7 o'clock at night, I go and I lock myself in my office and I just write. And I don't do it for any set period. I have a word count that I'm trying to hit every day. I know if I can get,
May I ask
15.
Your word count? May I ask
What's
your
that?
Word count? What is your word count?
1,500 words a day minimum.
That's a lot.
If I can hit 1,500 words in a day, I know I can crank the novel out between 3 and 4 months and have it be, pretty decent. Some days when I'm really going, or on a Saturday when I'm writing, I might be able to crank out 2,500, 3,000 words. You have to.
This one is about 80,000 or something. Moscow Station's about 80,000.
Ritzel's actually 105. Cold Shot's closer to 120, and then Moscow Station is about 105,000.
100? Really?
Yeah, first draft of Red Cell was actually 180,000.
Oh, my God.
And, I got my agent, and he's like, nobody's going to look at this if it's over 120. So I had to whack a third of that book out, and that was hard.
Everybody paraphrases Elmore Leonard. Dutch Leonard always says, "Don't write what people aren't going to read." So, an economy of words. My friend Jeff Deaver always says, "Use an economy of words," and I certainly didn't find your prose is very good. It's fast moving. I can say that it moves at a very fast clip, which for a reader like me is very important. I'll stray easily from a book if it doesn't hold my attention. So, yours was a one-day read for me, and I really enjoyed it a lot, which is when I contacted your publicist to ask if you would kindly be my guest. What will your next book be about, Mark? kind of, sort of an overview. I know you're not there yet. Don't give away, don't give us the farm. I just want a little peek inside the barn door, so to speak.
Well, this one is going to be what I'm working on right now. This one's going to be my mole hunt book. If you've ever read John le Carre's Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
All of them. Every book he's ever written. Yeah.
Yeah. This is sort of my Tinker, Tailor sort of story where there's somebody on the inside and they're trying to figure out, who this is, who's, doing damage to the agency. You got to get out of the office. You got to go out. You got to do things in the field and somewhat. And so the Israelis are playing in this one. And it's going to be kind of interesting. I don't actually know how the story wraps up just yet. I'm still working on that, but I've got the characters in it and I've got the story kicked off and it's rolling along and we're going to see where everything wraps up. But Jonathan and Kira, they're both in it. some of the other characters that you read in the first three books are also still in it. So there's some other familiar faces which are coming back. But, you know, I always do try to have the characters, you know, growing. I don't want them to end the book in the same place where they started. You know,
absolutely.
Characters have to change over time. And so
yes,
there are going to be some interesting changes to the characters in this book as well. Because, you know, one of the things about working for the agency is every so often, you know, somebody gets arrested for spying for another country. And, you know, whenever that happens, everybody in the agency kind of sits around and they just think, how could you do that? You know, what kind of person could do that and rat out their country? Which is weird when you think about the business that, you know, people who work for the agency are in, is to get other people in other countries to do exactly
find assets. Right, right.
Yeah. So
in your tenure there, and you don't have to be specific, has this happened? And, you know, I don't know. I don't know what would motivate someone to do that. It's just not my nature. I'm not an analyst. I'm not an analytical person the way that you are. But it would seem to me that this would be Burke's kind of a case that he would really do well in, even though this isn't Red Cell necessarily, is it?
Yeah, it's not the kind of thing that would normally fall under the purview of the Red Cell, but there's a reason that Kira will end up looking at this.
Okay.
Nobody inside the agency has been arrested since I've been there. But, you know, I started working for the agency just a few years after Aldrich Ames was arrested, who was
okay.
probably the most damaging, you know, traitor inside the CIA in history. And, I know a guy who sat not 20 feet from Ames at the time that Ames was doing his business, you know, and he talks about what it was like to work with Ames and stuff like this. And it's just, you know, it's a bizarre thing that, you come into work one day and you find out that guy you've been working with for 5 years, who sat right over there, was suddenly arrested, and he's passed all these things over to the Russians and whatnot. You know, and Robert Hansen got arrested at the FBI not too long after I started working at the agency. And the interesting thing about that case is, you know, the Bureau for a long time, they actually were suspecting, you know, that they weren't looking at Hansen. They were looking at somebody inside the agency thinking he was the guy leaking the information. It was a guy named Brian Kelly. And they went and actually accused Brian Kelly of being the mole when it was Hansen. And Kelly, you know, he was put on administrative leave and he was investigating. The FBI just, you know, they made that poor guy's life miserable for a couple of years while they tried to prove that he was the spy. And eventually the FBI, they couldn't crack the case. And so what they ended up doing was they ended up buying a file. From some other, there was a guy who said he could get his hands on the file that had a tape of a phone conversation with this spy. So they went and they paid this guy, I don't know how much, and he went and he got the file out of, I don't know, you know, FSB headquarters or whatnot, and they brought it back, cassette, and they popped it in the tape player, and they pressed play expecting to hear Brian Kelly's voice, and they didn't. It was Robert Hansen's voice. And the FBI was just like, oh, my gosh, and they realized it was their own guy who was doing this. So, you know, every so often you end up with a big spy case where something just blows up and rocks your world.
I wonder, you know, I guess in my way of, to my way of thinking, and I'm probably wrong, but those who are, like you said, moles,
mm-hmm.
it seems like if they were overseas or, you know, working to develop their own assets, and it'd be a lot easier to give away information that you know. Whereas if someone is sitting, you know, in Washington or in a building outside of Washington, how do you develop those skills or contacts to spy for so long? I don't understand that. It just seems like, you know, you're a nice guy. You're an analyst. You know, you look at intelligence stuff. I'm thinking, you know, what? Who would you tell? I mean, who do you tell? This is the confusing thing to me. It's because, you know, when I learn anything, it's usually about books, and I want to tell everyone, and people expect me to. But and if someone says I have a secret, I say, okay, wait till I drink a couple glasses of wine, then you can tell me. I'll never remember the next day. So, you know, but it's very different in your way of life and in your job anyway. I don't know about your way of life, but I look forward to hearing about the next book. And when do you think that you're going to have that out there?
Well, I'm actually supposed to deliver the manuscripts to Simon & Schuster sometime in the fall. And I think that they are wanting to target, I want to say it's mid-summer of 2017 for that one, when the e-book and the hardback would come out. So it'll be another, you know, I guess we're in April now, so about 15 months from now, that next one ought to come out, assuming that I can get the manuscript all wrapped up on time, which I, you know, try to do.
Well, let's talk about writing now, since, you know, I've kind of teased you a little bit about your hobbies. And I'm confused about your work because I'm not smart enough. So let's talk about writing. Do you enjoy writing, Mark? And what made you want to write a novel?
Yeah. The actual act of writing is actually, it's really painful, quite frankly. And I don't know anybody who really likes sitting down in front of a laptop and trying to bang out the story. The really fun part of writing comes before you actually write the book. It's the research, it's the thinking about the story, thinking about the characters, you know, the planning and the plotting and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It gives me an excuse to go read a lot more history and do a lot of things. That's the fun part. But once you sit down to actually write the story, that's tough. Because, you know, nobody's ever going to be harder on a writer than the writer themselves, you know. I sit there and I will write my 1,500 words or whatever, and then I'll go back and I'll look at it the next day. I'm like, oh, this is terrible, and you know, got to rewrite it and do all this kind of stuff. And, you know, we create something and all we ever see are the flaws. You know, everybody else will read it and say, oh, this is really good, and you read it and you just kind of like, I could have done better. That part of it's really hard. As for what made me want to actually write a novel, I don't know. It's just something inside. I've wanted to do it ever since I was a kid. I love stories. I love movies. Yeah, I've always loved reading fiction. You know, I love reading history because, you know, history in a lot of cases is just vastly more interesting than anything you could make up. And
sure.
So you want to, you know, there's a certain kind of person that likes to tell stories. And I like to do that. My only problem is I'm also the kind of guy who likes I'm the kind of guy, I like to read a novel and come away from it feeling like I learned
mm-hmm.
something real. I've read enough history in my life that if I'm going to read a fiction book, I at least would like the fiction to be accurate. And so I have a really hard time watching spy movies and reading spy novels because all I ever see is what they get wrong. So when I write my own book,
is it most of it wrong, Mark?
Well, in the books, it depends on who you read. I mean, there's some who are very, very good, and you know, get it right, and then there's some others I can't even touch them. With Hollywood movies, it's very rare for me to see a Hollywood spy movie that I think even came close. I think the last one that I saw, and suddenly now that I'm talking to you, the name of it flashed out of my head. You know, the Ben Affleck movie that won the Oscar a couple of years ago about the rescue of the American hostages in Iran.
You're talking to someone who doesn't see films. I don't own a television and I don't go to movies, so I'm sorry. The last movie I saw was actually at my friend's house. It was called Bridge of Spies with Tom Hanks.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, that one was very good, but that one is very well done and very accurate, and it's based on a real story. You know, and the same thing with Affleck's movie, Argo. That's the name of Argo. Also based on a true story. And they even shot some of the scenes in Argo at agency headquarters. They got permission to come in on the weekends and, you know, shoot when nobody else was there. So, you know, those you know, are probably the most accurate ones that I've ever seen. Most of the other ones that you watch, you know, the purely fictionalized ones, I can't even watch them just because I'm like, oh, they get so many things wrong. It's just too painful for me. And my wife hates that because, you know, she would watch Alias and Covert Affairs and these other TV shows, and I would sit there and watch it. And all I could do is sit there and, no, they got that wrong, and they got that. And finally she just kicked me out of the room because she just can't enjoy it while I'm sitting there.
Because you won't suspend belief, you know, that's the little trick. You've got to suspend whose books do you like to read?
Well, you know, when I was younger, I liked to read a lot of the early Tom Clancy novels. You know, I mean, Hunt for Red October is always going to be a classic, and some of those. You know, in the spy genre, Frederick Forsyth is very good. Day of the Jackal is just a phenomenal piece of work.
One of the best. Yes,
yeah.
I agree.
And the fact that he cranked that out in 30 days or something just blows my mind. You know, how this guy wrote it in 30 days, I'll never know. But, you know, for the most part, I don't tend to read a lot of fiction these days. I tend to read a lot more nonfiction. And as I get older, I just find, you know, real life and history to be vastly more interesting to me than most fiction that's made up. It's rare these days that I pick up a fiction book and go through and read it. Right now I'm rereading Caleb Carr's book, The Alienist, which I think is also a really great piece of work. But looking at the stack on my desk over there, it's all history from top to bottom. So I probably should read a little more fiction, but it's mostly history these days.
Well, you got to read what you love, and that's all there is to it. I'm so glad that you came on the show, Mark. I learned a lot from you tonight, and I appreciate the fact that your interests are so diverse and so eclectic, and it's a wonderful thing. You know, I would just love to be a fly on the wall in your house one day to see you doing all your various and sundry hobbies and writing as well. It must be very interesting for you. I wish you all the success with Red.